Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 177 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Thrust and Parry. WSU economist Randy Fortenberry takes on wheat and the world's woes. 2. About the continuation of my conversation with the Thomas B. Mick Chair in Economics at Washington State University, Randy Fortenberry. Before I get to the episode, some reminders. Be sure to check out the Washington Grain Commission's new virtual address at wagrains.org. We've revamped the website, creating a hybrid intending to inform farmers, landlords, customers, and the general public about wheat in the great state of Eastern Washington. As my boss, WGC CEO Glenn Squires said, quote, "It's important farmers and landlords are informed of the activities of the Grain Commission because it's their assessments supporting the organization's efforts. But overseas customers and a domestic audience in the U.S. also use the website as a resource," he said, unquote. Also, I wanted to extend my thanks to those of you who have liked or followed the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. New Wheat All About It episodes are posted there Tuesday mornings and include photos of my guests and PowerPoint slides when available. For those of you who haven't followed the Grain Commission, please consider it. Of course, I'd prefer everyone subscribe to Wheat All About It through their favorite podcast app because it's just so easy. By the way, the new website has icons of various podcast apps you can click to download. It's something important for Android phone users who don't have a built-in podcast app like iPhones. And if you've deleted the iPhone app, well, it's there too. I remember riding in the bed of a farm truck with Randy Fortenberry not long after he arrived at WSU in 2011. It was at the Lynn Field Day, and I asked Fortenberry, as the wind whisked through our hair, well, through his hair, whether he'd found a place to stay. Turns out he was in the midst of negotiating with an individual, but for reasons I can't remember, it wasn't going well. Problem was, I could tell he really liked the house. But it was also clear he was a person who wasn't going to buy it just because he liked it. As I recall, a month or so later, we were at a meeting together, and I asked him about the house again, and he told me it had fallen through. He was philosophical, but a bit disappointed. Then, lo and behold, at another meeting we saw each other. The house was his. I think of Fortenberry's house story now because it reflects a man not given to emotional decisions, and I wonder how much of that is brought into the way he does his job. Economics was once described the dismal science, but I think of it as a cerebral science, where market numbers and their trends require thinking about how they reflect and influence markets, indeed, the world. In other words, the numbers are the numbers, and it's how an economist thinks about them that separates the observers from the forecasters. Having listened to a lot of Fortenberry over the last 9 years, and boy, the guy can talk, I'd argue he is in the forecaster category. I know anywhere a farmer can cut his budget is good for the bottom line, but in my conversations with farmers over the years, I've never found fuel prices to be make or break one way or the other. Chemical and fertilizer costs are magnitudes of times larger in terms of costs. But I perceive Fortenberry may have a more holistic approach when I ask him about the ho-hum attitude of several farmers I talked to recently about declining fuel prices caused by the tumult occurring in the oil market.
I guess I'm kind of surprised to hear them say that, although they would know better than me what they think the biggest cost risks are to their operation. Certainly lower oil prices in general are good as long as it works its way through the entire system and you're paying less for diesel and you're paying less for nitrogen fertilizers and other things that are made from carbon-based fuels. Whether it's bad for oil prices to stay low, again, it's kind of a regional thing. If you live in the Williston Basin of North Dakota, relatively high-cost oil production area, or Gillette, Wyoming, or Southwest Wyoming, where they're doing a lot of fracking, it's a huge issue because you can't afford to produce at the current price. And so those communities, even though they're ag and energy focused, they're going to be very negatively impacted as those drilling rigs are shut down or fracking activity is stopped. If you're basically a consumer, then very low oil prices are a positive thing for you, whether you're a farmer buying diesel fuel or just a commuter driving from the Spokane Valley into Spokane to go to work. So, again, it depends on who you are and where your community is as to whether or not this is a negative. I think one of the concerns at the political level, the national level, is that we've become a net energy exporter and have sort of insulated ourselves from some of the concerns about the ability of other exporting countries to influence our economy by manipulating what we can and can't import in terms of oil. So we've had, you know, a nice period here where we were less susceptible to what OPEC did or what other potential oil-producing countries were doing. And so there's probably some political concern about what happens if we start shutting down our higher-cost production facilities and relying more on the import market. And what does that do to us in terms of vulnerability to our economy if, in fact, those other importers start trying to manipulate what does and doesn't get traded?
The farmers that I talked to were not very excited over the lowering of fuel prices in terms of the fuel that they put in their tractors and combines. But a lot of the inputs that we apply to the land are based on petrochemicals. Will input costs decline, or is it too soon to say that that will happen?
Well, it's too soon to say it'll happen because it takes a while to go from the price of the basic commodity to get it into the retail sector. One of the reasons oil prices are so low is storage facilities are basically full in the U.S. Well, if I'm refining crude oil to diesel, I'm actually refining crude oil I bought maybe a month or 6 weeks ago, and the price I paid is not the price you see today. So what I'm going to want to charge for the fuel that I produce is going to be more a function of what my input cost was 6 weeks ago, not what oil is trading for today, for example. So it does take a while to work its way through. In terms of the producers, you know, all the spring crops, they already bought all that stuff. So when the price at the very end of April went negative on the futures market or very low on the spot market, those guys, the producers already bought their chemicals, they bought their diesel fuel, they'd already used much of that. If the price stays very low, oil prices don't rise over the summer much, then what they pay next fall for fall seeded crops, winter canola, winter wheat and things, that's when they might start to see some advantage. But really, the current crude oil price hasn't translated any advantage to them because most of those inputs were already purchased and used.
All right. So, you know, we are not a corn growing area, but you have said, other economists have said that the wheat price follows the corn price. Corn prices have been falling.
Yeah, actually, the wheat market has been amazing because it's held up very well given this decline in corn prices. Usually, if you sort of look at the soft red wheat futures and the corn futures markets, the contracts closest to expiration, on average, the corn price is maybe 75% of the wheat price, maybe 80%. As of a week or two ago, it was closer to 50%, which means as the corn price has collapsed, and the corn price has been steadily declining since the first of the year, and wheat prices have been more volatile. They've gone down, but they've gone back up. We've had some movement in both directions. The wheat price has held up very well given the corn price. What's a little disconcerting is over the last week or two, well, let's say the last 3 or 4 weeks, the wheat price has given up about 80 or 85 cents in the futures, and corn's only given up about 35 or 40. So it looks like them coming back together is happening by the wheat price adjusting to the corn price as opposed to the other way around. One of the optimistic scenarios one might have had a few weeks ago was that the corn price would respond to the wheat price by moving back up as opposed to bringing the wheat price down. They do move in the same direction. So sometimes wheat prices drive corn prices. Sometimes corn prices drive wheat prices. What does seem to be happening over the last couple of weeks, though, is the wheat price is adjusting to this relatively low corn price. Whether or not that's going to continue, I don't know. Corn has had a little bit of a bottoming action here the last few trading days. So maybe it's sort of found its bottom for the going into the summer months. I don't really know that. If that's true, then maybe wheat can stabilize as well. But it is very hard to maintain a corn price at 50 or 60% of the wheat price. There will be some adjustment bringing those back together over the next couple of months.
Yikes. Any silver linings in the wheat market?
Well, a couple. I mean, you know, you have to, the silver linings are, in a relative sense, maybe not an absolute sense. So a couple things. One is the wheat market has held up very well as the corn market has steadily declined since January. So that's been a bit positive. The expectation very early on, and we'll see how this comes out in the May World Ag Supply Demand Estimates when USDA gives us their first official look at the 2020-21 marketing year. But the expectation is maybe for a little bit better wheat prices next year compared to the year that we're just going to be winding up here in about 4 weeks. If you look at what most basic commodity prices have done in agriculture since the first of the year, as we've gone through this pandemic, prices are down for all major commodities, but wheat has lost less value than most other major commodities. So I'm talking corn, soybeans, cattle, hogs. So wheat's done a little bit better than the other commodities as we've gone through this health disaster. And the last thing is exports are better this year than a year ago. So we have made some improvement in the export market. That's not true for soft white wheat, unfortunately, but it's true for the wheat basket in general. It's still going to be a little less positive by the time we get to the end of May than I thought it was going to be back in February, but a significant improvement over the last year nonetheless. And so that's a positive sign moving forward also.
All right. Randy, I've read various pundits saying that this pandemic changes everything, that people aren't going to go back to the way that they were doing things. Life will be different. I mean, I would like some changes to stay in place, but I'm a cynic and I don't think they will. Economically, are there any long-term impacts in your forecast that might be with us for a while?
That's a really good question, and part of it depends on sort of how the timeline of the pandemic plays out. If it turns out that we're kind of on the back end of the curve and we don't have the second phase that many of the health experts are calling for in the fall, then, you know, a year or year and a half from now, it might look more like it did before the pandemic. If it turns out to be more of a sustained issue that we deal with, and so I've read as much as 2 years that the virus will still be relatively active as we work towards some sort of a vaccine, then I guess it depends on what you mean by the long term. There probably will be some changes that are more permanent. And it could be things like how people interact between home cooking and meals away from home. For example, as we've watched red meat prices really collapse, and now we have this challenge with processing of red meat, the plants that are being closed because of the high incidence of COVID among the line workers, a lot of the high-end red meat cuts are consumed away from the home in restaurants, more so than at home. And the fast food industry has a huge impact on meat demand. When fast food restaurants feature bacon on their burgers, the price of hogs responds very positively and very quickly. So if it turns out that there's less eating out over the next couple of years than there had been going into this situation, that could have a significant impact on the way meat prices materialize, and that'll affect feed demand, so things like corn. So I doubt if we'll go back to exactly the way we were. How close we get to that's probably a function of how long it takes for this to play out and what the perceived risk is of going back to your old social way of behaving.
All right. So there have been discussions about countries protecting their food supply, food nationalism, I've heard it called. I would argue that most of the countries we export to can't replace wheat. Anything for wheat farmers to be worried about in terms of food nationalism?
Well, for traders, they should be worried about nationalism in general, because one of the things we're talking about in the U.S. is manufacturing nationalism and not relying on, especially China, for example, for things like PPE or drugs. Well, if we start to restrict trade in terms of what we allow to be imported, we should expect, as we've already seen with the entire tariff wars last year, trade to be restricted going the other direction with our exports. So their biggest concern would be maybe not food nationalism, but nationalism in other sectors that affects food trade. We've already seen food nationalism, and we've seen it have a significantly negative impact on U.S. agriculture, not on wheat markets, but for many wheat producers that also diversify with pulses. As India tried to protect its own pulse production system, tried to become self-sufficient in lentils, for example, they imposed huge tariffs on the U.S. and Canada. And the result is our pulse markets really collapsed here because our export opportunities really disappeared. That wasn't pandemic related, but it was food nationalism in the sense that India wanted to support their own pulse sector and try to be food self-sufficient in the pulse markets. And so, you know, Montana lost half their pulse acres in a year because the price just collapsed. Pulse prices here were very negatively impacted. So anytime you start talking about restricted trade and your commodity is mostly driven by trade, there's things to be concerned about.
You know, I think of wheat as this non-perishable commodity, and I think of that as an advantage. It transports easily. Is that an advantage of wheat during a pandemic?
It may be an advantage of wheat. One of the challenges is when you build up huge world stocks, the only way you replace those is through consumption. They don't disappear because they are perishable, right? So when you have a very large stock situation like we do right now globally, then for consumers, that's good because it might stabilize food prices. But for producers, it's a challenge because you're still trying to produce a commodity that's in quite abundant supply and not disappearing as fast as stocks are growing. That might be a negative of a non-perishable. But it's also true that if it's not stored properly, the quality deteriorates. So, you know, an example that's always brought up is we don't really know what the quality of the Chinese wheat stocks are, even though they hold half the world's stocks. So we don't really know if they're consumable, not consumable, what kind of products they can go into, what kind of products they don't go into. The biggest advantage to the Pacific Northwest is we produce a wheat that's different from everybody else's, and that does have relatively high demand. I mean, even, I should have mentioned this as one of the positives, we sold 131,000 metric tons of wheat to China this year, soft white wheat out of the Pacific Northwest. That's amazing. I think last year it was 8,000 metric tons. So we have great market opportunities because of the uniqueness of our product. But I don't think the non-perishability part of it is necessarily a positive if you have excessive stocks already globally.
Okay. I want to get back to the trillions of dollars that we're pumping into the economy. And I don't think people really understand what $1 trillion is or even what a trillion is. I found this on the internet. 1 million seconds is 12 days. 1 billion seconds is 31 years. But 1 trillion seconds is more than 31,000 years. Billions to trillions is of a magnitude leap, and yet we don't talk about what it means for our economy and the future of our children. Am I missing something here?
I don't think so, but it's all in the context of the times, right? So if the economy was still chugging along like it was a couple of years ago, then the idea of printing trillions of dollars and infusing it into the economy would be horrific to many people. But in this current context, that's really not what anybody is focused on. I mean, to be quite honest, I was very surprised before the pandemic broke that we could run a $1 trillion deficit, and most of the deficit hawks suddenly didn't seem to be as concerned as they were back when the deficit was $500 billion. And I think part of it is just a function of context. What else is going on at the time that does or doesn't influence the way you think about that and where the money's actually going? It is an incomprehensible number. I remember, I wish I could remember this guy's name. I think he's the guy that used to give out the Golden Fleece Award.
Senator Proxmire.
Yeah, Proxmire. And I think it was him, but I might be wrong. But I remember one time a debate about the federal budget. And he said something like $1 million here and $1 million there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. Now we're talking about trillions. And this is only 40 years later.
Back in during the Iraq War, we had a Secretary of Defense who talked about the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. I'm curious, Randy, what might be the unknown unknowns of pumping this much money into a leaky vessel?
Well, I think the biggest concern really is if there's a significant resurgence in inflation and the cost to service that debt becomes much more burdensome than it is at current interest rates. And the other thing is, what we don't do very well is we sort of claim we're doing temporary infusions of capital, but we don't go backwards very well. We don't go back and cut budgets. And so one question is whether or not we're actually just setting up a new trajectory of government payments, government expenditures, and we don't actually come back and say, okay, that was just a temporary infusion, and now we're going to come back and exercise some austerity as we move forward. And that happens, in my opinion, as you look at what's happened over the last 4 or 5 years, that happens under both types of administration. It doesn't really matter which party is in control. It's hard to cut back on government expenditures that we've kind of gotten used to.
Yes, yes. So, Randy, is there anything else you'd like to add here talking about the market or what we see in the world?
No, I think I do think even in the current environment, I'm a little more optimistic about the wheat market this coming year than this past year, but exports will be critical. I think I've been really concerned about the strength of the dollar from the first of the year, but the last few weeks we've seen some moderation. That's positive. So hopefully we're able to maintain the level of exports. It'd be nice to get exports above a billion bushels for wheat this coming year. It'll be interesting to see what USDA says in about 10 days in the next World Ag Supply Demand Estimates, where they'll give us their projection of the 2021 crop year. In some way, it's our first look at it, but in some ways it's not really good information, because what they'll do is they'll use the March planting intentions report for spring acres. They'll sort of use historical yields, trend yields. So the production number will be a little suspect, especially any place that's had some problems either with late planting or crop progress going forward. And the demand numbers will be a projection of last year. So the price won't mean much, the market year average price. But it still starts to give us a baseline from which we can evaluate how we're doing as we move forward.
That WASDE report Fortenberry is referring to was released May 12th. Wait, that's today! Or at least it's the day I posted the podcast, whether you're listening to it now or not. It's rare my podcast posts and government reports come together so neatly. Go ahead, Google WASDE, WASDE, May 2020. And the May 12th report should come up first on your list. Now's the time to see how close Fortenberry's thinking comes to the WASDE reality. After you've checked out the report, make sure you return here next week for another episode of Wheat All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.